Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The newly transformed Dilworth Plaza, now Dilworth Park, officially opened this month along the west side of Philadelphia City Hall. And many, if not most, who will seek it out as a destination don't know very much about its namesake. Looking to redress that are Peter Binson and Jonathan Binson, father and son, and authors of Richardson Dilworth, Last of the Bare-Knuckled Aristocrats. Peter and Jonathan, thanks for joining me on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
This is a book about a man and a time in Philadelphia, and what a different time this was. Dilworth was born at the turn of the century, initially in Pittsburgh, but he came to a Philadelphia that would scarcely be recognized by most who live here now.
That's true. He came in, I think, 1926, John. He'd been born in Pittsburgh, grew up in New York, and went to Yale and then Yale Law School. But before that, he went off to World War I as a 19-year-old Marine infantry private and got himself almost killed. He and five buddies, all from, I think four from Yale and one from Princeton, all went off and volunteered in the latter stages of that war. Three of them were killed. Dilworth and two others were badly wounded, and the only one who survived without, didn't even see combat, was Teddy Roosevelt's nephew. And Teddy Roosevelt had urged these boys to get in the fight because he thought that's what you should do. And his nephew didn't get in the fight. He went to officer candidate school.
That fighting spirit, of course, served Dilworth well throughout his life. Jonathan, the next step was to return home and go to law school and practice law.
Yeah. One of his closest friends, Wells Cummings, who was at Belleau Wood with him, was killed there. And when Dilworth came back home and re-enrolled at Yale, he took a trip down to Philadelphia of condolence to Wells Cummings' intended, whose name was Elizabeth Bobby Brocky. And before long, they were linked up and eventually got married. And then after Dilworth went to law school at Yale, they moved down to Philadelphia, and he took his first job as a lawyer in Philadelphia.
And Peter, we learned that the legal system was very powerful in Philadelphia. The politics, completely Republican, lots of cronyism, lots of corruption at the time as well, all in a WASPy environment.
That's true. And it's hard to conceive of it existed. Now, it's so different. Not that we don't have a lot of corruption now, but it was quite a different world then. And it took Dilworth a time to make sense of it. It was his father-in-law who really got him to Philadelphia. His father-in-law was very prominent and got him the law school position, or the law firm position.
So he entered politics, and he didn't always win, but he always had big aspirations.
Well, he lost, I think, three times. He didn't win until he was in his 50s. He never gave up. He was a fighter. He was kind of a mixed bag personality. Very attractive man, very witty. It was always fun to cover him because he was such a charming guy. He was very careful about his dress, always dressed beautifully in double-breasted suits. And yet he could slug it away with the paws and be as tough and nasty as they were.
Now, I understand that specific attribution, bare-knuckled aristocrat, came from his mayoral rival, then a 33-year-old Thatcher Longstreth, also an Ivy Leaguer.
That's right.
Yeah, it was during their I think that Longstreth wrote it as a memorial tribute after Dilworth died. But Longstreth ran against Dilworth in 1955. Is that right, Dad?
55, yes.
55. And he was a complete neophyte. Dilworth was, by that time he had been DA, so he won that race. And he'd had three other campaigns running for mayor, governor, state senator, and really was practiced on the stump. And Longstreth was kind of clueless and really discovered in that race just how the game was played from Dilworth.
One of the fascinating things that comes to light about that game in the book is that there were a scheduled 18 debates. Thatcher was a fast learner, though, because apparently after 12 of them, Dilworth said, nope, he's coming on too fast.
That's right. So the day after the election, Dilworth took Longstreth to what club was it?
Anyway, Bellevue Stratford or something, I don't know.
And they talked about it. And Long said, was amazed. How do you keep all those facts in your head? You keep beating us with those facts about the city government. Dilworth said, well, we made it all up, and nobody would know any better. That was Dilworth.
And Longstreth said they just laughed and laughed about it that next day.
It was a landmark election, marking the first time, I believe, in some 67 years that a Republican was not in office in Philadelphia, that Joe Clark and Richardson and Dilworth tandem first, and then Dilworth emerging as mayor from 56 to 62, I believe.
Right.
Then he went on and tried to run once again for governor.
Yeah, once again is right.
Yeah, he ran against William Scranton in 62. And he, because the rules had changed, he had to resign as mayor to run for governor. And he really was mixed emotions about it because it seems like he was really enjoying himself as mayor in his second term. But he really had this desire. He always had wanted to be governor, but it never quite worked out. There was a series of races. He ran in 50 and got trounced. Then in 54, he was in office as DA, so he couldn't run, even though they asked him about it. In 58, things seemed to really be lining up. He was in his first term as mayor, and he seriously considered running for governor. But he made a speech in Washington in which he was asked if he what should we do? Should the Chinese be permitted into the UN? And he said, I think we should. You know, we've got to talk to our adversaries. Kind of rings a bell these days with Obama. But as a result, you know, he didn't think anything of it. But the next day, it was headline news all across Pennsylvania that he, you know, during this red baiting era, he would have been willing to parlay with the Chinese. And even though he was pretty close to the lock to be the candidate, he got pushed aside then by David Lawrence of Pittsburgh, who himself then became the candidate.
Toward that same end, he also went toe-to-toe with Joe McCarthy.
Right. That was unusual in that McCarthy was so powerful. People were terrified of him. And like John F. Kennedy would not attack him because we're partly due to religion. But Dilworth did. And Dilworth later came to have a great admiration for John Kennedy, by the way. He thought he was wonderful. But at that point, it was really Dilworth attacking McCarthy. And I don't think won him any votes, but it showed what guts this guy had.
You, Peter, worked for the Philadelphia Bulletin and Philadelphia Inquirer for decades, and much of this book talks about the relationship between Dilworth and the Annenbergs, first Father Moses and then Walter Annenberg. It was a very different time, the way Philadelphians got their news.
Right, it was. The Annenberg came to town after buying the Philadelphia Inquirer. And the
sort of 1936.
And the Bulletin was kind of middle of the road. Bulletin wouldn't attack anybody very hard. But there was the Record, the Philadelphia Record. There was liberal paper, and it was hammering away. And it really went after Annenberg. And Dilworth had no particular interest in Annenberg. But the story that Dilworth tells, and you never could tell, he was so self-deprecating whether this is true. Dilworth said Annenberg tried to find all the top lawyers in town. They were all down the shore up in Maine in the summer, so they had to pick him. So he ended up as Annenberg's lawyer and was phenomenal.
This was a lawsuit that the Record brought against the Inquirer because they thought the Inquirer was trying to get out of an agreement for distribution of papers, a joint distribution agreement.
So, like many candidates, then new Mayor Dilworth promised to change the city. How did he do so?
Well, of course, he came in after Joe Clark. Clark was an amazing mayor himself, very intellectual. Didn't get along with the ward leaders very much. He was didn't have time for them. He could be arrogant, but he knew how to run a city, and he brought in top people from all over the country to run the departments. Ended patriotism.
Patronage.
Totally patronage. And he really did a remarkable job. Meanwhile, Dilworth was equally remarkable as district attorney. Because when he became DA, It was a sleeping preserve of part-timers, just no pizzazz. Dilworth changed everything around, brought in young, excited people. Sam Dash, who later became, you know, on the co-chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee, said working for Dilworth, it was like you never wanted to go home at night. You felt like you were 10 feet tall. And there was a Leon Higginbotham, who became a very prominent African-American jurist and won all kinds of awards for it, said that he couldn't leave anybody he admired more than Dilworth.
It was a very racist time in Philadelphia in the 1950s when he came aboard.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and Higginbotham was one of the first black lawyers to argue in the Court of Common Pleas, was
yeah,
it?
That's
and
right.
That was Dilworth who yeah. opened that door.
Yeah, yeah, I thought his 4 years as district attorney were remarkable. And really more exciting, I thought, than his period as mayor. I mean, he did some very good things as mayor. But Clark had really set the pace. And I guess the thing they get most credit for is
Society Hill.
Society Hill, which is supposed to, you know, one of the prominent urban renewal projects in the entire country.
And what specifically was he championing in that regard?
Well, it was Ed Bacon's conception, and Dilworth carried it out. Dilworth got the money and clout to get it done.
Dilworth's execution.
Yeah.
Also, post-politics, he became involved with the Philadelphia Board of Education.
Oh, boy.
What a time.
I covered education in that period for the Bulletin, and I was just amazed at what this guy did. I thought it was, you know, in almost every measure, he improved the quality of the public education in Philadelphia. More teachers, better pay for teachers, kindergartens in every classroom, libraries in every classroom, special projects, very innovative stuff, which was attracting attention all over the country. I thought, that's wonderful. Well, it was good for 6 years, but then nothing seemed to change after he left office. We went back to a slough of despond, and here, that's where we are now.
The last of the bare-knuckled aristocrats, I was trying to equate him with modern politicians and perhaps aspects of, what, Ed Rendell or Chris Christie come to mind? Would you agree?
Yeah, I think he had someone.
Ed Rendell is a nice comparison.
Ed Rendell is closer.
Is someone smart.
Actually, Dilworth would have envied Rendell because Rendell not only had 2 terms as mayor but 2 terms as governor. And for some reason, Dilworth was really itching to be governor and he never made it.
The book also discloses many personal aspects of Dilworth's life. A divorce at a time when that was really shunned and he was apparently socially ostracized for a time because right. of it, and also his bouts with problems with alcohol.
Yeah. The alcoholism was not anything that we knew about. I mean, I had a front row seat at the Bulletin when these changes came. Because I got there in summer of 51, and in the fall, the Democrats took over. And they've been running it ever since, of course. But never a hint of alcoholism. It didn't affect his performance, either as mayor or on the campaign. But it was very serious for a while.
Of course, there was a time, at least they said so, when in Philadelphia nearly everyone read the Bulletin. What was the role of the newspaper in politics, culture, the life of Philadelphia during that period?
It would be hard for me to judge because I was so much a part of the newspaper. But I can tell you, when I'd get out at 30th, go up to 30th Street Station to go home at night, and everybody would be reading the Bulletin. I mean, it really did have tremendous circulation, real clout. It did not throw its weight around. It didn't try to pick candidates for public office. And so I don't know how it's... I think it set a tone that was good, but the effect was not as much as you would have expected.
At the onset, we talked about the new Dilworth Park, and of course we learn in the book that Frank Rizzo, who was then in charge of the city, really didn't want any tribute. Many young people presumably go there who, again, don't know much about the man. What are 2 or 3 key takeaways that you would like to impart about his role and his legacy?
Number one, his love of the city. This guy was really proud of Philadelphia. A lot of, you know, naysayers about this place forever. You know, Philadelphia isn't as bad as some people say it is and all that. Dilworth was upbeat about Philadelphia. He loved the city.
He hated the self-deprecation.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I most admired was in his leadership was that he... As I said, he was very self-assured because of his wealth and background. If things went well, he always credited his associates. If there was a problem, he would take responsibility. And he attracted really talented people, unusually talented people, who loved to work for Dilworth. That's, what I think, what made him so remarkable.
Dilworth had divorced in 1936 and remarried Ann Kaufman Hill.
Who also divorced.
Who also divorced at the same time. It was a huge scandal. And they and her family had was very wealthy, and her father, I think it was, had built this enormous house on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, right on Lake Superior. Gigantic place. And anyway, they would go there for vacations. And so one summer, they went up for summer vacation. Before they left, Dilworth heard from John B. Kelly's office, who was then head of the
City Committee.
And to say, we'd like you to be our candidate for DA. Dilworth said, okay, great. He hadn't really put his hat in the ring, but I'll do it. They go off to the Upper Peninsula, and then 4 or 5 days later, a telegram arrives saying, come back to Philadelphia. So he does. It takes him two nights on the train, one down to Chicago, another one to Philadelphia, walks into the office, the Democratic Party office, and John Kelly's not around, but his assistant says, oh, they changed their mind. So Dilworth, and with no explanation, so Dilworth said, in his own account, he says, I just put on my hat and went back to vacation.
You know, only as you invoke vacation, we neglected to touch on the vacation that he and his second wife took 6 months after his first term in office. And would you like to take a moment and describe that luxury liner escapade?
Yeah.
Go for it, John.
Well, Anne and Dick Dilworth were vacationing in Europe. And on their way home, they were sailing on the Andrea Doria, which was an Italian. They were coming from Italy. Was it an Italian liner? I'm not sure.
It was. Yeah.
And not far off Nantucket, in the middle of the night, they're nearly home. It was T-boned, broadsided by another ship, and quickly started to sink. And Dilworth was one of the, the two of them were in bed, knocked out of bed by the collision. One woman who was in a cabin not far from theirs, near where the prow of the other ship hit the Andrea Doria, was found on the deck of the other ship, fine. She was ejected out of her cabin right onto the deck of the other ship. The Andrea Doria wound up sinking in about 6 hours, and in the process, nearly everybody...
In the scheme of things, unlike the Titanic, there were apparently some 1,700 survivors. There were dozens of fatalities, though. And the story is that he was among the last to leave, making sure others reach safety.
Right.
And there was an Italian person on board was quoted somewhere saying that he noticed that there was a tall man really helping the crew getting everybody off the ship. He said he was... It was Sindaco, the mayor of Philadelphia.
That's great, Sindaco.
So Dilworth, he had a pretty rough go in the first months of that term. He came back and they loved him.
Thank you so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Peter Binson and son Jonathan Binson, authors of Richardson Dilworth, Last of the Bare-Knuckled Aristocrats. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY.